Thomas M. Dish committed suicide July 4th, 2008, a few weeks after this conversation was recorded. Okay, so I am here with Thomas M. Dish, who is the author of The Word of God. Tom, how are you doing today?
Very well, thanks.
There is one problem in terms of you declaring yourself God, and that is the fact that there are all these four-legged animals that are running around in various parks that are not called Hicksids or whatnot. So what's up with this?
We're not
called... They're not called Hicksids. They're called dogs.
Yes.
Well, how do you contend with this? You've got some competition here in terms of who would be calling you God and the like.
Well, I'm not a monotheistic type of God. Nor was Jehovah, because he said, "Thou shalt have no other gods before thee. I'm a jealous God," and all that. So he was looking at the competition.
Yeah.
And he tried to create a monopoly for himself.
Yeah.
I'm much more permissive.
It's interesting that you use the word monopoly, because many of the pronouncements you have in this particular book, whether it is truth or whether it is fiction, I have actually a couple of questions I'm just going to throw with you at once. I'll start with a commonplace one in terms of whether this book is in some sense a response to this idea of truth that comes with the memoir that is now a commonplace problem among the publishing industry, the James Fry's, the J.T. Leroy's, in some sense, of whether this is authentic now. I mean, do you think that there's too much of a problem, too much of a concern about books being authentic or lies, that really truth is entirely a sort of subjective wilderness to wander around?
Well, I present an example of a truth that's there just to be fun. What I don't like, what I'd like to make fun of, are the Fry's of the world or the Whitley Strieber's. I did a real number on Whitley Strieber in The Nation, and that was picked up in various places that reprinted it all over Europe. And I think that kind of lying is reprehensible because it's bullying. And it's a kind of bullying that's easy to identify and sneer at when somebody like Strieber or Fry does it, because it's so easy to disprove. It's harder to contend with the high and mighty ministers of religion who do that sort of thing. The Catholic Church has done a wonderful job of making itself unbelievable, thanks to all the pedophile priests.
Yeah.
Who could have expected that kind of their making my job easier? It's just reading an article in The New Yorker about the new evangelicals of the right, who are less and less of the right wing and more accepting of Democrats. But Barack Obama still has to contend with the likes of Reverend Dobson, who tells him that he's not a good theologian.
Yeah.
As though Dobson were somehow gifted in that way.
Yeah.
So I think it's nice that religion has become a field of contention again. And there are all of these books about saying, "I'm an atheist and I'm proud of it." Well, that was like unthinkable 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Nobody dared. I was in a science fiction convention in North Dakota, as far away from civilization as you can get in this country. And even so, it was a very large auditorium, and it was filled with people. And at one point I said, without thinking to offend anyone, that I was an atheist, and there was this gasp in the auditorium, as though none of them had ever encountered a live atheist before.
I think you only see atheists running around like gazelles in the wilderness, you know?
Right.
In fact, in some areas of the country, you know? Mm-hmm.
Well, that was certainly one of those areas. And, well, that's a battle tactic.
Yeah.
You know, if you make the people you disagree with anathema and heretics and enemies whom, by definition, you won't even listen to, you've won the battle in advance.
I'm wondering if some of the footnotes, which often entail references to previous work that you've done, as well as various philosophers and thinkers that you quote obliquely, if this is your way to play with the idea of authenticity. I was thinking, when reading this book, of Clifford Irving's mm-hmm. Great Ruse, and whether authenticity comes from both annotation and also this commentary in terms of constantly...
Footnotes are to have fun with. I mean, what? I'm a science fiction writer. I should have footnotes. It's like delusions of grandeur to have footnotes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And some of the footnotes are very funny. Some of them are just, you know, telling people who my publisher was for an earlier book or citing chapter and verse. But I guess that's the key expression, citing chapter and verse. That's what footnotes do, and that's what fundamentalists do. They have this conviction that if something is in print, if it's a book, that makes it sort of holy or holier than thou. And so I thought, well, this is a book too. And so, and real books have footnotes. And so I've got a lot of footnotes.
I'm wondering, though, if there's a danger that some people might read this book and overlook the poems and the stories. You know, they'll overlook that. They'll look specifically towards the commentary track, so to speak, of mm-hmm. this ongoing dialogue that you're having about what it is to be a god and what it is to be a follower in this mm-hmm. particular universe. Is that not even a distinction for you? Was this kind of a way to corral a number of things?
I like a book in which the ground is always shifting. That makes it livelier, I think, for the readers. It certainly makes it more fun for the writer. This book got written very quickly because I was having fun and because I didn't have to make one continuous argument. I think that's sort of dull. So, and the old-fashioned books on atheism, like Ingersoll in the 19th century. He was America's first large-scale, hugely popular freethinker. And he gave chautauquas, talks, in tents that were set up for that purpose. And there were... It was like a traveling summer circuit. And often they were devoted to heterodox speech making on such subjects as, well, I don't think there really is a Trinity. I think there's just one God, which at one point in America was, you know, a big can of worms. I mean, I think Emerson got kicked out of the college he was teaching in because he wouldn't admit to being a Trinitarian.
Yeah. I wanted to also ask you about A.J. Budrys, who I know you... I saw your live journal. There were many caustic remarks directed his way, but I should point out that when I received this galley, well before June 9th when he uh-huh. died, you referred to him as the late... Algis Budrys.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you had some inside dope or if this is another example of your divine powers.
I guess so. I mean, I never know what my divine powers are going to do often until they've done it. And that this is certainly a case where I had picked the right horse without even knowing.
Why did you... type the late so early on? I mean, because
I've always had, well, for one thing, I didn't know.
You didn't know he was alive.
Yeah, I sort of figured it was likely that he was dead, and wishing it to be the case,
yeah.
I just wrote it that way.
Yeah. Or he was dead to you, in other words. Dead to you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, if I had my druthers, there he is.
I wanted to ask you also about the cycle of stories in this book that begins with A Man with Mystery. You have Thomas Mann sleeping with a young woman producing a man-sired Thomas Dish. And
well, the world of the future expects him to do this.
Yes.
Right.
But this seemed to me an intriguing commentary on your part on the notion of simulacra, because you're suggesting that there is this alternative reality that is laid down through this act of Thomas Mann. And
that
of course,
the past is malleable.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And you, this almost seems to me a response to Philip K. Dick, which we'll talk about. I'm happy to talk about with you in a bit. But I wanted to ask you about the notion of whether this represents the idea of if you are a god or a creator of fiction, you have certain taboos to play with in setting down an alternative reality. And this suggested to me on your part that Dick did not actually go nearly as far with The Man in the High Castle as he could have. I wanted to ask you about this also in light of the fact that you present a commandment, thou shalt not fight war. So it seems as if you have your own particular limitations here in your own simulacra.
Well, I thought I should have something like a commandment.
Yeah.
And you can see, I was brought up Catholic, and Catholics get good moral education in the matter of the Ten Commandments, because the Jesuits were so good at finding exceptions to every rule. So, you know, sort of, that's called casuistry.
Yeah.
And I was, from an early age, a good casuist, because that's, we had a whole hour for religion class, and the thing to do was sort of to come up with interesting counterexamples. And that's fun.
But as to this idea of the Thomas Mann spawning, I mean, were you playing around with alternative realities and simulacra and limitations
of having Thomas Mann for my... Doesn't every child have this fantasy of they're not my real parents? This is my
I don't know. I didn't have that fantasy, but if you do, that's
my real parents. You know, sort of, I'm actually the son of a king. Well, I didn't, you know, sort of choose a king for my real father. But if I got to pick, you know, sort of just one daddy in the whole world of possibilities back then, Thomas Mann has always been my literary god. And it's wonderful how the itinerary of his travels in the United States worked out. He was a good diary keeper and letter writer. And those things have all been published, and I traced his travels at, you know, 9 months before I was born, and he might be, you know. It's not impossible.
Well, where do you play with the notion of what is true and what is false here? I mean, you know, depending upon how you define those particular terms, we get into a great chicken and egg argument here, but I mean, to what degree is this book predicated on true events? I mean, I can go also into the griping you have for various agents and editors throughout this book.
Well, in the Thomas Mann thing,
yeah.
I couldn't have said with the same playful probability that Maurice Ravel was my father, because he wouldn't have been anywhere near where my mother was at the right time. Mann was. So, I mean, and that delighted the con artist in me. In my book about science fiction, I talked how much of American literature is devoted to the celebration of con artistry. Melville has a whole book about the confidence man. Poe was that kind of trickster many times in his life. It's a venerable American tradition. And I realized that I'd never, sort of done my job there. And this was my opportunity to participate.
It may be a venerable American tradition, but 20 years ago, you could have hypothetically put this book out as either an autobiography and a memoir, and people would have believed it. I think of Anthony Burgess's two-volume Confessions, which mm-hmm. is clearly a pack of lies, an enjoyable, picaresque pack of lies.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, today, if you do that, you either have to have a disclaimer that it indicates that all these are composite characters, or in the case of this, it has to be put out as a particular novel. I'm wondering if there is something about this venerable American tradition that is now being lost, and how, again, I think this kind of goes back to my initial question of how much this is a way to subvert that.
I think it wouldn't have been as much fun as a book if I took the kind of fuss to make it all, do you think this really happened? I mean, you're limiting your readership, for one thing, to the people who are so gullible they'd actually believe it, which is like saying, okay, dopes, come and follow me. I'm the Pied Piper, and I'm going to lead you to a new land. And there is that kind of tradition in science fiction, L. Ron Hubbard and Whitley Strieber and all of these people who want to be taken as being for real. Frey is wanting people to believe him. But, I mean, he doesn't have anything else going except the particular set of lies about himself. It's not as though you're going to have to join a church, or all that you might be involved in is paying $25 for a ticket to hear him in person tell his lies.
I'm wondering if it's a sense then, because with James Frey, it's really the inflation of himself to create this I'm the ultimate badass notion. Whereas in your book, it's a matter of creating it within a religious construct of suggesting that you are this great deity, a rather benevolent deity. Mm-hmm. And essentially, I'm wondering if lying in some sense is more legitimate if you attach it to something like an institution like religion.
Well, he gave me the claim of godhood, which hasn't been disproven, gave me a platform from which to address many of my favorite subjects of debate or contention. Celebration. Because a lot of what I do as God is simply to point out different aspects of creation that I'm particularly proud of, or aspects of my worship by my followers, or the followers of other gods that I think are deserving of notice or commendation.
Are there,
like the Sistine Chapel.
Yes.
Right. Or Verdi's Requiem.
Do you have followers as we speak right now that you are aware of, that have written into you, that have declared that you are the god so far?
They're on the book jacket, some of them.
Yeah.
Mike Moorcock thanks me for having cured his cancer.
Well, there's also, speaking of the blurbs, I know, I found this out through reading the John Clute review, that essentially you ask these people to commit their blurbs without reading the book. And so, what of this? Is it, again, this seems to play with this notion of what is authentic.
Well, what I was asking for in the blurb was simply their testimony to my efficacy and worthiness as a god. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't have to read the book to proclaim that.
Yeah.
Karen Joy Fowler read the book. With some of the early ones, it was too late to get the book to them. And she was like the last one in the door, and she got a chance to read it. But, and hers is like one of the most unequivocal.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's interesting, too, because you're asking these people to believe in this faith without having read the book, which is very reminiscent of religion in a nutshell here.
Yes, it is. There's good precedent for that. And Christ, in fact, pointed out to his apostles that the centurion who came and said, my boy is very sick, and Jesus said, okay, I've cured him, but the kid wasn't there with him. But the centurion said, great, thanks, and went off and, you know, sort of believed that his son was cured. And Christ says, isn't that, you know, a great example of faith? And it is, right?
So, speaking of gods, I want to go back to the notion of Philip K. Dick, who you address in multiple stories in this, but to kind of offer some of the history here.
Well, the Dick thing is a continuous story.
Yes, right. Yes, that's true. But it is predicated upon a 1972 letter that he sent to the FBI.
That is true. That happened.
But there's also, I tracked down an hour 25 interview he did in which he had said, I always meant to ask Tom Dish where he got the idea to get syphilis that made you brilliant, although he told me peripherally that Thomas Mann had syphilis, in fact, tertiary syphilis, and that the more his brain burned out, the more brilliant he got. And I was going to say the next time...
He posited that function of syphilis in the novel... Dr. Faustus.
Yeah.
Not that Mann had.
That's what Dick was saying. And then he then went on to say in the same interview that A Scanner Darkly was a sadder novel than Camp Concentration. I want to ask exactly what communication you have had with Dick to create
he
this.
He wrote, at the same time he wrote the letter to the FBI.
Yes.
He also wrote this letter to me, sucking up egregiously and praising the book, the same book that he was denouncing to the FBI, as evidence either that I was a communist or a Nazi.
Anti-American, in other words, he used in the letter.
Uh-huh. But the example, he wasn't sure in his own mind when this mysterious person came to his door soliciting him to introduce the premise for... Oh, that was the funny thing. Why I was able to write Camp Concentration is that they came, these mysterious people, and gave me the idea, sort of like aliens coming and impregnating me with their...
Well, the specific verb he uses in the letter is encoding.
Yes. Well, to me, that's just... blatant and very naive envy. He liked the book a whole lot, and it was science fiction of a sort that he thought he should have written. And so he had to think of a way, of a reason why I wrote it, and he didn't.
How soon did you find out about the FBI letter?
Not until he was dead.
Really?
Yeah.
Were there any communications between the two of you to clear things up aside from these letters? I mean, did you talk to him on the phone to kind of...
Oh, I made one long visit to him in California at the beginning of his Valis frenzies. And he did all sorts of... He wanted me to sort of say... Gee, there must be something in this. You must be in direct contact with something strange. I mean, and he had lots of evidences for why, you know, there had to be something supernatural behind all of this. He diagnosed his son's hernia before a doctor did, and other bizarro reasonings. He had dreams in Aramaic. Now, how could he have dreams in Aramaic? Because he'd never studied Aramaic.
Yeah.
And he also never sort of wrote out what it was in Aramaic that he'd heard in the dreams. He was telling lies for third graders. And I wasn't in third grade anymore. And I don't think most of the world was. He is trying to take in his idea of a popular audience. And sadly, the world has become more educated and hip since he started writing and bamboozling people.
Yeah. You point out this idea that he was a pulp fictionist in his lifetime and he avoided this state of being a millionaire, which also connotes what you wrote about Clement Brown and the Ode to St. Nicholas and the major who had his... He never actually got to see authorship in his lifetime. It was only after his death that he was able to see this. So it seems to me that this is an interesting preoccupation of yours that is centered possibly around Dick, but also relates to this thread in literary history of people not being able to see their accomplishments recognized or praised or given the credit that they actually deserve. And I'm wondering how this, you know, relates to the act of being a writer in the present in this unknown future where we have no idea how our work is going to be regarded by others, or if it's going to be turned into Hollywood movies, or if it's going to be collected in Library of America editions, or what.
That, all of that material has shifted since I wrote the book in drastic ways. Last night, a friend of mine and his protege, Ben Downing, and a young, bright fellow, whose name is Jeff, and I can't remember his last name, but it was heartening to meet a young fellow in his 20s who was so well informed and such a good arguer. And one thing we were considering, the three of us, was just that question of how literature is going to survive in the next century, if at all. I mean, ABC or CBS is having an hour or two long program as to will Western civilization last another century, or will it self-destruct because of oil shortages and flooding and all of the ways we look like we're going to have an ecological implosion. Well, that's changed every writer's odds on literary immortality. I mean, I've always thought, well, Gail has my papers in the Beinecke Library. I've been published in certain places, and now we're entering an era of digital encoding, so that
encoding again,
and the ubiquity of one's presence through a world of cybernetic libraries. I mean, there may already be access to Tom Dish in outer space. It's certainly gone up to satellites and bounced back. So on the one hand, writers are everywhere, and everyone who's on the internet is there in some ways forever. I think it's wonderful that I've got this blog, and now instead of bothering to send my poems out to magazines, I just put them all in the blog. And there seems to be a pretty good readership all around the world. I get like comments from people in New Zealand and in Germany, and now there's somebody in Germany who's translating my poetry at a goodly pace. So in that sense, every writer is more, can make Shakespeare's boast.
Yes.
About, you know, sort of that he's going to outlast bronze and monuments and such things. On the other hand, bronze and monument and such things may be going down the same sinkhole as cyber information in all its various forms. I mean, the planet may be doomed.
Yes.
And if that's so, there goes everyone's chances. And in a way, isn't that liberating? Doesn't that allow us to gather our rosebuds and not worry about who's going to last longer?
Yeah. It's very biblical, actually, the way that we describe this notion of floods and oil and depletion and the like. But at the same time, one can also argue, I mean, I guess it depends upon whether you have an optimistic or pessimistic belief in the universe or in the world. I mean, we've been through scrapes before in the past, and it's very possible we could go into an age of barbarity, but out of the Middle Ages came the Renaissance.
Right.
So it could just be an inevitable cycle.
And also, you know, these are time-bound things. Why should the future have, oh, what is the word? Why should it be valorized above the past? Why should carrying on and lasting a long time be better than having been great? The whole irony of Ozymandias, King of Kings, look on my works, ye mighty in despair. Great poem, but if you've ever been to those places that have pyramids and really ancient survival mementos of past vanished civilizations, it does encourage a bit of philosophy and relativism on those lines.
Well, concerning this issue of your poems, I mean, have you stopped submitting them to literary journals? You just put them on your live journal all now, or?
If they ask me for, I some editors know that the blog is there, and this guy will, John Mella, is the editor of Light, looks at my blog and takes. Let's see, I know one of these was on the blog, Payday USA. Parnassus doesn't do as many poems, but he reads the blog. I know that I get a good readership, and postage costs so much now, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Well, and there's, of course, there's email submissions. But then again, there's this notion, the Johnsonian maxim, that nobody other than a blockhead ever wrote for anything other than money. I've just probably mangled the quote. But there is this. I mean,
nobody's ever earned money from poetry.
Yeah.
I mean, the very best places, like poetry, in my time submitting there, they were paying $2 a line. And that was top dollar. New Yorker paid more, but with the New Yorker, you know, there's a limited number of people who are allowed to suck up to the poetry editor.
Yeah.
Joan, well, it's not her anymore.
Yeah. Well, actually, I want to ask you about this notion of essentially shit-talking editors throughout this book and in various other books. I mean, you suggested in an interview with David Horwich that you could never be published in The New Yorker for this particular reason, that they can smell where you came from.
Yeah.
And at the end of this book, you badmouth your former agent, Glenn Hartley, for never managing to sell any of your stories. You
well, that's not why. I mean, I explained that afterwards.
Yeah.
But why I badmouthed him is that he said of this book, this is a slap in the face to every publisher in America. Well, if somebody says that, I'm just reporting what he said. But, you know, should somebody who says that to you be your agent?
Yeah, but then there's the story, The Second Coming of the Christ, and you point out, you describe how the editor rejected your story for the simple reason that they hate my guts, that editors in general do this. I mean, do you really think that all editors despise you as a person? I mean, why take these things so personally?
Well, there are certain editors who do hate my guts within the field of science fiction. Critics, too. An example would be the late Algis Budrys, who was my enemy from the first time he reviewed a book of mine, my first novel.
Yeah.
We hadn't met, but he had a profound dislike of me then. There were a number of people in science fiction who take an evangelical's view of any gay writer. I mean, they would burn us at the stake if the law still allowed that.
But even today? I mean, things are clearly different today.
Well, I, you know, started my career in 1962, and certainly through all my first science fiction novels, there were plenty such in the field, yes.
Yeah. But I'm wondering, is it really fair to suggest that everybody hates your guts or to essentially really project all this enmity towards those who don't appreciate your work? Because it could, again, it's this notion of taking things personally that I'm curious about. That is,
well,
there.
I have a very good inside view of who hated me how much because they put it in print.
Yeah.
So there were vivid moments of... There were people who did everything they could not to have me in the field. You know, one would not be invited to certain places, or teaching gigs, that sort of thing. Anything with an honorarium attached.
Mm-hmm.
Good example. The Florida science fiction academic critics has never invited me there. And that is run by with money from Stephen Donaldson, whom I've given a very bad review to, and who walked out of his way not to shake my hand when I was in Florida, off my own financial bat, to speak on for John Crowley.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there is one enemy who would do anything rather than shake my hand.
Yeah. But why care about this? Because you have a niche here. You have people who are reading you. You have people who are looking at your poetry.
I'm not obsessed with it.
Yeah.
But if you have enemies of that sort, why be nice to them? Why not say they are your enemies, you know it, and then ridicule them?
But I'm wondering if one is an enemy simply because another person despises
not
what you
simply
do.
Because,
you know, I mean,
no.
There's this notion of civil disagreement,
many,
you know?
There's many...
You want to talk about religion? It's like...
Religion has an aspect that's called organized, so that there is... like a phalanx movement of Catholics on certain issues. And they oppose as one man abortion and other things, like homosexuality.
Yeah.
And so they're fair game to criticize as hypocrites in the matter of homosexuality, since the priesthood is filled with pedophile priests.
Where do you stand on non-overlapping magisteria, though, in light of this particular question? Stephen Jay Gould's notion that, well, atheism can't exist with religion because there is this non-overlapping magisteria, and therefore there won't necessarily be bad blood between the two respective antipodean ends.
Oh, I have some Catholic friends who are... When I was in Rome, one of my favorite dinner companions claimed to have been the confessor of the fat pope, John 23rd.
Yeah. I think so.
And the man, that's to say the priest, was surely gay, and we often dined with his young lover, who was writing his... a PhD thesis on D.H. Lawrence. And they were very civilized fellows. The priest was marvelously fun at dinner. And that's been true of the higher, the better educated sort of Catholic for a long time. Similarly in in England, there's all sorts of people in the church who are supremely civilized. The editor of my poetry books in England is the son of, I forget what the word is for right-hand man, of the Archbishop of Canterbury, not the present one, but a couple past, and he grew up with the commons of the cathedral as his playground, and he is as civilized a fellow as you could ask for. So, of course, you know, sort of religion has many excellent intellectuals in its ranks. I have no quarrel with them. They have no quarrel with me. It's the lumpen proletariat, Reverend Dobson's of
the cowboy that you mentioned in the Stick story, in which you actually present this scenario of something you admire, you confess to your love of Western wear, and in fact, this is very interesting because it's almost as if this particular type of mentality is worn like some common sartorial fashion here.
You know? Is, yeah. it's virtually official. And some of them are conscious of that side of things, too, and are playful about it.
I also wanted to ask the notion of literature as a religion. You address this at one point in the book where you write, "I fear that Tristram Shandy will join Don Quixote as one of the masterpieces of world literature that I can never be credited with having read," but you still hold out hope that you might actually finish The Tale of Genji, or perhaps you have finished it.
No, I haven't, and I have less. I made it. I made an attempt after I wrote that to mount the hurdle of people who've made it through Genji assure me that you just have to get past the first 300 pages and then it becomes fun.
Yeah.
But that's too high a hurdle for me now.
But there seemed to be something within this statement that was that suggested that we perhaps hold too much faith in what is established as a classic, that it really doesn't matter. Again, going back to this notion of finding your own particular niche.
Well, it may not matter, but it's critics serve a useful purpose in pointing us the way to go, that we are likeliest to enjoy. A friend of mine is facing the choice of, he has a break this summer long enough for him to read one of the big long classics, and he was somewhere between, he was undecided between The Magic Mountain and Richardson's Clarissa, and I have read those two, and so I would be just as undecided because their virtues are so different, but I finally urged him to read Clarissa because it's more of a page turner.
But I mean, how does this relate to you as a writer? Does one need to necessarily read particular classics as in establishing what you view as a classic or what you view as a father, in this case, Thomas Mann?
Well, the reason he's a father is because I like books of his that I've read so much. When you've read one book by somebody and you think, wow, that's terrific, then automatically you have a list of things you've got to follow up with, the man's other books. And usually there's a consensus as to which are the best of those other books. So that's where that's a good place to head. I don't think one should read approved classics just because they're classics, but because they're likely bets for either entertaining you hugely or for giving you a more comprehensive vision of the world that they issued from. And I think that's a good reason for reading that classic. I think Clarissa is a worthwhile investment of one's time if one wants to have a picture of the world that generated Jane Austen. Lots of people understand and have read all of Jane Austen, know a lot about the world of Regency London, but the earlier 18th century that she emerged from, there are other books to help you get hold of that. What I think is the most incredible novel of the last 50 years is the Aubrey Maturin series of novels by Patrick O'Brien.
Yeah. Very good also, because that's, you learn so many nautical terms, and you learn what it is to be at sea.
Not just terms, but why seagoing was so important, and how it was a scale model of society at large. Just the organization of those ships was like the organization of the nations of the time, and this is something people a simile that is a standard one in our culture since the time of Homer, but no one has ever explained all the ways that this is a true correspondence. And I think the Aubrey Maturin books are the most intellectually compelling picture of our civilization that exists in a fictional form.
So in your view, this is what fiction should set out to do, to provide this absolute, almost topographical and holistic bearing upon what it is to be alive. And maybe this is one of the reasons why you have avoided some of these other books. You're more interested in this kind of...
No, I mean, I've never written a book that does that. The virtues of my books, whatever they are, aren't the virtues of Patrick O'Brien. And they don't possess the ambition, the model-making ambition. There, just as there are many gods and many temples to them on the streets of my heaven, so there are many kinds of novels that I like, and some of those kinds I've written.
Is this why writing the text adventure game Amnesia appealed to you? Because you were able to provide this Aubrey Maturin notion in this new medium? I mean, in that game, I know that there are very specific details about New York topography, which relates to this particular
The model building side of it was fascinating. I got to build a verbal scale model of Manhattan. I think it was a waste of time, for one thing, because there's no audience for that game now, because the technology so fast outgrew what I tried to contain within it. And at this point, the interest in gaming and such is in the hands of the model builders and the people interested in developing the technology itself, and the writers who might want to. There were a few real writers, old-fashioned type writers, who did try and get on the bandwagon of cybernetic creation. Robert Pinsky was one of them. And I think all of our stuff has simply been rendered obsolescent within 5 years of its writing.
Coover teaches the notion of hypertext as well, and writes has written a good chunk of this idea of something similar to amnesia, I suspect, but this idea of a constantly changing medium, and he devotes all of his attentions to this idea that well, we have to inhabit the now, we have to inhabit the present technology, even though we know that it's going to change. Again, we get to this question of operating in the present while not remaining certain of the future. It could be argued that, okay, technology will change, but it's just uncertain as this idea of whether the world will go to hell, you know?
Yeah, what happens is that it's no man is an island, and that's true of the creative impulse. To try and write for this new medium, you're going to have to work within that industry. And it's like early filmmaking. You could make a Western, you could make a Keystone Cops comedy, you might be able to make a horror movie, but, you know, sort of the literary action was really somewhere else, and it isn't the writers one remembers for the early silent movies, the early talkies, it's the directors.
Still the case today, as well, unfortunately.
Or not. I mean, it should belong to the director. And the director should be somebody who can command the services of a good writer, the way Hitchcock did. But, I mean, why do I write so much poetry? Does anyone read poetry or care about it? Only a few other poets. And you wouldn't be here today if I'd only written poetry. There's just, it's a specialty interest. Now, I write poetry because I think it is the hardest thing I can do very well. And so I simply enjoy the doing of it as an equestrian enjoys spending time on a good horse. Poetry is my good horse.
Well, Tom, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh.